Hello and welcome to the Race to Alaska podcast. I'm Jesse, the race boss, here in beautiful Port Townsend, Washington. The tulips are blooming, the high schoolers are capsizing lasers and FJs. It must be spring. Hey, speaking of high schoolers, joining me today is high school teacher and used to be race boss, Daniel Evans.
Yo, Jesse, how's it going, man? Good to be here. It is a beautiful day, isn't it? It's a good time to be talking about the race.
Absolutely. It's coming up soon, and it's good to have you back. But I got to say, it's been hard to nail you down. What have you been up to? What's going on? Any of it been on the water?
No, I can't say anything's been on the water. I mean, though, everything's tooling up. I'm getting the boat ready. Been playing in the mountains a lot and, you know, putting my newfound high school teacher shop skills to test down in Portland, helping people build houses. It's been good.
Oh, that's pretty sweet. Daniel, it's been a bit since you last threatened to race R2AK yourself. I couldn't help but notice you didn't apply this year.
You know what? It almost came that I was going to be racing with Carl Kruger, I got to say. If I get to race, it's because you moved the freaking date a little bit later. That's what I need.
You handed me the keys. Like, what do you think I was going to do with this thing?
I know. You're going to be a stalwart bastion of R2AK culture and deny everyone, including myself, which is exactly what you should do.
All right. Great. Perfect. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm expecting to see you back with your own team in 2026. All right.
Thank you. I'll do my best.
All right. Great. But let's talk about this year's teams. This week, we're doing three teams, folks. In fact, we're going to be introducing three teams a week from here on out, because it turns out there's not that much time left before the race, and there's only so many weeks and there's only so many podcast episodes. So we're going to be cranking out extra large episodes until the race starts.
All right, sweet. So who are we talking first about this week?
Okay, well, let's fire this thing up with a soloist. Race to Alaska has only been attempted by a stand-up paddleboard three times total. You just mentioned the one and only person who's ever done the whole thing. It's only been done once. So Peter Allen of Team Sup and Irish, he's going to be the second sup artist in history to race to Alaska. And he made it over 500 miles to Klemtu last year. So I think he's got a pretty good chance.
Yeah, no doubt. I think he's got a really good chance. He's well prepared. And I'd be interested. I'm more thinking about it, how's he going to do time-wise compared to Carl's initial record. That'll be cool to see.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to him.
Yeah.
Peter, you're back.
Yes. Took a little bit of convincing of myself, but when you guys announced about a month ago now, you were moving to every 2 years, that kind of pushed me over the edge to sign up for this year because didn't want to wait 2 years. I think if I'd waited 2 years, the momentum and motivation might have been gone.
Yeah.
I really want to have another crack at it.
Sure. Can we remind folks about what Race to Alaska looked like for you in 2023?
Essentially, I got to Klemtu. My GPS said I paddled from Port Townsend 813 kilometers, probably like 500 miles-ish, and 15 days, if you include the first day. So
that's a pretty short description when I ask you to describe your Race to Alaska. And you say, well, I wound up in Klemtu. That is leaping pretty far.
it was quite the journey. Ended up sharing most of it with two other paddlers, Scott from Sporting Chance and Stuart from Bella Bella and Beyond, I think his team name was.
Yep.
I'd connected with Scott quite a bit before the race. He was in Victoria, I was in Vancouver. And I was kind of looking for people to not necessarily paddle with, but kind of just know on the race and might be moving at similar speeds, just to, especially for the crossing, the proving ground. See where we went from there. So Scott and I paddled the proving ground together. We turned out to move at pretty similar speeds, so we decided to start the race together and kind of see where it went. On day four, we pulled into Camel River for lunch. And there was Stuart from Bella Bella and Beyond saying, hey, how's it going? Can I paddle with you guys? And we're like, sure, more the merrier. And then, we ended up, the three of us paddling up the coast together. Had some really short days on the water with the big Northwesterly, came through Johnson Strait. I think we had 3 kilometers as our shortest day. And then the following day, we had perfect paddling conditions and we did 110K in one day. Yeah, just everything just lined up. There was very gentle teal breeze, the currents in Johnston Strait, and we just kept paddling. And it turned out to be a really kind of made up for the time we'd lost the previous few days. Yeah, I got around Cape Scott and up the coast. And yeah, for me, unfortunately, Clam 2 was the end of that journey.
Well, let's talk a little more about that in a minute. But on a trip of that pace, hooking up with other people can be huge. I know whether it's going on a paddling trip for some distance or you're doing a long distance hike, you wind up falling in with a crowd of people and it really morphs your experience into something completely different. And that support is huge.
Yeah, for sure. You know, leading up to the race, I was pretty determined to just do my own thing and be solo. But as it got closer, I was like, you know, some company might be good if it works out, especially earlier in the race, getting up kind of across the Strait of Juan de Fuca and up the coast through Seymour Narrows. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think in hindsight, it was actually the best decision to connect with those guys and paddle with them. We all kind of worked well together. We all kind of brought different things to the kind of the group dynamics, and it worked quite well.
I know, because I was there on the dock, of course, when Scott and Stuart arrived, and they were happy to have finished. As happy as they were to have accomplished and completed it, they were very acutely feeling the loss of you, and that came up in the conversation very, very quickly, that they had wished you'd been there with them.
Yeah, and I remember watching that live on Facebook Live, and it was pretty emotional seeing those guys finish and not being there.
So I had heard, because I obviously I wasn't there in Clem 2 with you, but from their description, it sounded like you're in pretty rough patch. Like that's a really hard thing to have to make that call. Can you talk a bit about what led up to that decision and how that went down?
Yeah, just kind of, I think I've been feeling it for a couple of days before that. Kind of see where did kind of all kind of start going downhill for me. And I ended up with the withdrawal. I think just the day before we went around Cape Caution, they're turning a big northwesterly, and we kind of me on the paddleboard, I got hammered from the wind from one side, and it was it's pretty demoralizing on the paddleboard to be kind of having the paddle on one side, because you kind of get really just it's hard in the body to be on the one side the whole time. We got around Cape Caution okay. It was a lot of time on the knees, which was really hard in the body. Yeah, we started the next day up as it Fitzhugh Sound, kind of heading north towards Bella Bella. And it was it was great. It was flat. We had some current. It was awesome. And the same thing happened again. It turned into a big kind of westerly wind and was getting hammered. And it just kind of, those kind of 3 days kind of just really wore me down. A lot of paddling on my right side. I found my board didn't track very well across the wind, not as well as I'd hoped it was going to. So it was really hard work. Yeah, the day before Bella Bella was probably one of the hardest days I ever spelled on the water. Yeah, that day was a really dark place, and Stuart really helped me through that and get me to Bella Bella. I just was really just totally exhausted. My body felt really worn out. We had a really good time at Bella Bella. I thought, okay, this is kind of, we spent like 24 hours one night there. Felt like a good recharge. But yeah, the next day up to Clam 2, my shoulder started getting kind of painful. I'd never really had shoulder pain before, so I was really worried about damaging myself. And going further north in Clam 2, I wasn't sure how easy it would be to get out of the race if I had got to the point where I couldn't paddle. So I decided to kind of just pull the plug there. And it was a pretty... I think it wasn't, the decision had been coming for maybe a good 24, 48 hours, but and it was, I don't know.
That sounds rough. I mean, even almost a year later.
It was a rough few days, for sure. And it was, you know, in hindsight, it was the shoulder was it put me over the edge and made me the kind of decision to kind of pull the plug. But I think if I'm really being honest with myself, it was a combination of just having a couple of really hard days, tired, just kind of being, just a really hard few days and tired and shoulder was hurting. And I think I think I was just done, unfortunately.
All right. Well, let's move on from this downer subject.
Yeah. Well, no, it's, you know, it was a downer, but I think it really taught me a lot about myself and, you know, how to deal with it in the future if and when it happens again. Because I'm sure the same kind of conditions will probably happen, and it might end up in a similar kind of place. And I'm hoping that experience will allow me to kind of better kind of ride that low.
So you mentioned like a big part of that was that, you know, you had that westerly, you're paddling on your right side. In the elapsed time between last race and this coming race, what are some steps you're taking, maybe improvements to your board or training that you think are going to allow you to overcome that?
I think the improvements on my board, we've put a kind of forward fin box towards the nose of the board and getting a fin set up that should allow the board to track better across the wind. We're also, I have a friend here working on a steerable fin that you can adjust by hand. Still very much the prototype stage, but we're getting close to a version that works, I think. So that'll also, it's close enough that I can just reach down to the board and change it with my hand. So that's something else we're going to take, and hopefully it'll help track across the wind. But also just another big learning point was, because we were positioning on the water versus where the land is. Because the day before Bella Bella, we ended up on the eastern side of that sand, where really we should have been on the western side. And we didn't kind of look at the big enough picture of where the wind was coming from and where it would hit that sound, which is the big learning point. And yeah, I think I need to stop and rest sooner than did before. I think as much as I really enjoyed paddling with Stuart and Scott and just basically sharing the experience with someone else, but there was a time that got me further than I might have got by myself. But I think paddling as a group was a bit of a double-edged sword for myself, because they could move faster and more easily in the worst conditions in their kayaks or in surf ski. And there was times if I was solo, I would have just went to shore and took a rest and waited for the wind to pass. But because they're moving in a group, I was like, oh, we've got to keep cracking on because these guys are doing okay. So that's definitely a learning point from what happened last year, is just need to be a little more cognizant of what I need, not necessarily the group if we are in a group.
That's a good learning. Yeah. That you've got to race your own race. And Peter, there's nobody else racing the race the way you're doing it this year.
Yeah.
In fact, up until this point, I mean, we can count on less than a hand how many attempts have been made on a stand-up paddleboard. Why do you think that is? Like, there's a stand-up paddleboarding in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years is just exploded. It's everywhere. You see people on a SUP everywhere you go. There's these endurance races. Why haven't we seen more people doing it in Race to Alaska, you think?
That's a good question. And SUP is a relatively new sport still. Like really, what are we, like 15 years ago, SUP didn't exist, right? You know, whereas people have been canoeing and kayaking for thousands of years. And I think, you know, the limits of SUP really aren't really fully explored yet. Like some people are out there doing these kind of bigger, crazier events, bigger trips on SUP, but they're few and far between. You know, I think SUP does lend itself to being a very good recreational sport. These bigger, challenging races are like they're definitely hard. There's no doubt about it. And they're, you know, in reality, the kayak or canoe is probably a better craft for this kind of race. You know, sitting down, you can deal with the wind and the waves and stuff, especially if it's against you, much better.
It sounds like you're saying that it's because it's a stupid way to do it.
It's not the easiest way for sure, but yeah, if it was easy, it wouldn't be any fun, right?
So 15 years the sport has been around. How did you get into it?
Well, I'm originally from Northern Ireland, hence my SUP and Irish team name. And I came to Vancouver to go skiing for a season in 2012 and never went home. I decided to stay here. Vancouver's a pretty nice spot. You've got the mountains in the backyard and kind of the ocean in the front yard. You can do ocean sports, mountain sports. You know, I can be in skiing in 40 minutes from my house. I can be paddling 15 minutes from my house. And you can do both in one day, all year round. Well, not all year round, but in the winter, like I can paddle. It just doesn't freeze over here like lots of parts of Canada does. And yeah, with the skiing, when I decided to stay, I ended up bumping into the manager of a paddle sports shop in downtown Vancouver called Eco Marine. And he was looking for people to work kind of rentals in the retail store. I knew nothing about paddling at the time, but he was like, if you can sell stuff, I can teach you what you need to know about paddling. And I was like, sure, that sounds fun, working downtown Vancouver on the waterfront, doing kayak and sup rentals and doing a bit of retail maybe. And yeah, I think my second day there, we had one of the board reps came around with some demos to do kind of product knowledge on those boards. And that was the first time ever on a sup. Did my first race, I think, 2 weeks later, and was hooked for it. Yeah, been paddling ever since.
2 weeks after the first time you're on a sup, you're racing.
Yeah, I did like a 4 kilometer race. We still do the weekly race series here in Vancouver from kind of April through September.
And now, I mean, I've got a list here of the races that you've done. These are not small things. Things that stand out are the Yukon River Quest, 715 kilometers. You've taken both second and third place. Yeah. There's other ones in here, multiple 100 kilometer races. So you jumped in, you race. That is your way of connecting. Why racing?
I've always been a pretty competitive guy. I just love the community around the races and the people you meet. And you know, I love kind of having a purpose to the paddling. You know, you're trying to become as efficient and kind of go as fast as possible. I'd always been kind of drawn towards people who, you know, endurance events and people who do these kind of crazy ultra marathon runs and paddles and all sorts. And when Yukon River Quest announced that they were allowing sups in 2016, I was like, oh, that could be kind of fun. I didn't sign up then because I thought it was kind of crazy and I couldn't do that. But then we had a couple of local guys here did it. I was like, you know what? I could probably do that. So in 2017, signed up and yeah, made it happen. It was a pretty big learning experience. And then, yeah, just from there, I had a knack for endurance and, you know, mentally I could kind of switch off and kind of, it's almost like a meditative experience paddling those kind of distances. I find you kind of just kind of zone out and you're paddling and next thing you know, 4 hours have passed.
So if your limits at this point, if your limit so far is Klemtu, and this year you find that your limit is Ketchikan, have you an inkling of what the next limit might be?
Oh, I don't know. I think, yeah, well, I guess we'll have to find out. Get to Ketchikan first and figure it out.
Have you been connecting with anyone else racing the race this year beforehand?
Yeah, so locally here, there's Bruce from Bowen Island and another kayaker here. There's a blank on his name. In Deep Cove, team winging it. Is it winging it?
Team Let's Wing It. Martin Rother.
Martin Rother, yes, of course, Martin. Yes, yeah. I see Martin every Tuesday night racing here.
Uh-huh.
I've seen him a few times out training, just met Bruce recently last week, but I've known Martin for a couple of years now. Yeah, so chatting to both those guys. Yeah, might reach out to a few other of the Kim and Human powered people and just kind of see where they're at and how they're doing. And yeah, I'd love to kind of connect with someone to try and get the proving ground out of the way.
Yeah, we're going to have a pretty good field of, it's a diverse race field this year. We haven't quite released all the teams yet out to the public, but that's going to happen here pretty soon.
Oh, cool.
And we're sitting at about 40 teams for the whole race, a couple more that are just going to Victoria. And yeah, it is, there are some interesting vessels and some fast vessels. Some super slow boats. And I think it's going to be really, it's going to be a hoot. A lot of people probably go in your speed.
That's fun. Open for the company.
Yeah, company's a good thing. Are there any sponsors or supporters that are helping you out on your trip this year that you'd like to shout out to?
Yeah, like the biggest shout out probably goes to Blackfish Paddles, my employer. Yeah, they supply me with top-notch stand-up paddles. That's also allowing me the time off to do the race, kind of in what it really is peak season for us.
Sure.
Yeah, my boss David's super accommodating, and he's very, very supportive of stuff like this. Yeah, so Blackfish Paddles. Yes, another shout out I want to make. It's all the people who you messaged and supported me last year. It was amazing. I couldn't believe the message I was getting from out of the blue, and people sending me pictures, and just really felt the support and love.
Well, you're doing a super inspiring thing. I'm talking with you pretty casually here, but what you're attempting and what you already have done is something that very few people in the world are trying to do. So it's very inspiring to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's yeah, like it was, you know, Carl doing it in 2017. That really inspired me to kind of, that's when I first heard of the race, and I was like, you know what, that mm-hmm. could be fun someday.
Yeah.
Yeah. It took me 6 years to kind of finally figure it out.
Well, then we'll see you in 7 weeks.
I've always said the hardest part of the races is getting the start line. Like once you get the start line and get going, that's not easy, but
it's straightforward.
It's straightforward. Yeah. It's on you have one mission, start paddling and see where you end up.
All right, Peter, we'll see you in about a month and a half. Good luck with your training.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Daniel, tell me three awesome things about Fishery Supply.
Oh my God, that's so easy. I'll give you two. Carl, Alex, owners, father, son, their vessel Disco. And I'm going to throw in incredible Chandlery ever. How about that? Four.
I would agree. Two awesome humans, a wonderful vessel, Disco, which, by the way, if you've been following the race, ton of that footage that you've ever seen shot on the Race to Alaska course has been shot from the good vessel Disco. So those are good answers. And I would also add that their delivery service, bar none, beats everybody. Amazon can go to hell. Their Fisco truck is going to be where you need it to be every day. When I want chip brushes, I get chip brushes.
100%. Amen, man. Amen.
All right, Daniel, let's turn now to a team you interviewed just a couple days ago. And this one feels pretty special, pretty out of the ordinary.
Yeah, they're incredible because it is, team Victory or Duff. There's a lot of wordplay going on in that. But it is six from the Royal Canadian Navy, which is incredible. And they are coming out in one of their old life-saving boats. The Navy actually sanctioned this. They went and said, we want to take one of these old life-saving boats that hadn't been in like full service since like late 50s, I think. And we want to take it out. And we're talking, 27-foot open boat, 8 rowing stations, 3 sails, not a lot of freeboard. They got some incredible energy. I got really excited about them working together because they seem to balance each other really, really well.
That is great. I'm pretty pumped that we have an official team from a Navy in this race. So hear that, other Navies in the world, all you other Navies with your little boats sailing around, you've been called out.
No doubt. No doubt. This is all being recorded. I always say that Jesse's going to edit this, but I think it's a big fat lie. I don't think he edits anything. And we'll know when you listen to this, if I say big fat lie in the beginning, it's because he didn't edit anything. That's the test.
You've been warned.
Yeah, exactly. So, first of all, it looks like the whole team is there. And I'm wondering real quick, you can just introduce yourselves. But then also, every one of you is part of the Canadian Armed Forces.
Correct.
And, one of the things I think is really interesting about that is that probably a lot of listeners, meaning many Americans, will be surprised to hear that Canada has armed forces at all, because most of them, I would say most people, when they think Canada, they think peace-loving, hanging out at Tim Hortons, eating some poutine with some Molson, and being really kind to one another. So, and that's not a bad rep to have, but yes, armed forces. So who y'all at, and what part of the armed forces are you with?
So we are all Rig Force, Royal Canadian Navy. So the Navy portion of the armed forces, hence a Navy.
It adds up. Yeah. Okay. Can you just, I'll say your names. It'd be great.
So I'm Jeff.
This is going great so far. We're all doing really well. Okay, keep going.
Ellery Down, team captain.
I'm Ben Roth.
I'm Evan Thorpe, token NCM.
My name's Max Lucas. I'm also an acting sub lieutenant.
An instigator, I would say.
I took part in writing the proposal to get us to this point in terms of having a team, the Royal Canadian Navy putting together a team?
I want to come back to that because I think that's really, really interesting.
And then, yeah, I'm Max Vandal, Sailor First Class, and I don't know, let's just see what happens and hopefully win.
I gotta say, when I was first reading your bios and I saw Max Vandal, I'm like, that is such a cool ass name. I wish I had that name.
Yeah, it's nice to have it on uniform, proud and center.
That is good. That is really good. Okay, so instigation, because there, I think your story is interesting. All stories in the race are, I think, pretty interesting. Yours is interesting for a number of reasons. But one is that you talked the Navy into letting you do this, right, on one of their older lifeboats. What was that? What was that like? Was it hard, or were they like, "Yeah, you're a bunch of idiots. You're disposable. Good luck."
So, I run a program in the West Coast called the RCN Sail. It's a sailing program with sailboats. And so Max and I were hanging out one day last September, and he's like, "I love small boats. I love them too." We started talking about the Race to Alaska, and he goes, "Well, I'll let you carry on from here."
The Service Whaler, the boat that we're going to use, it's got a long tradition in the Canadian Navy or the Commonwealth Navies, as a sailboat, a racing sailboat, but also the lifeboat and used, you know, in service and training. But we had one where we work, and it's used for ceremonial purposes. And it was like, why can't we use this in the Race to Alaska?
So he asked me that, and I've been in long enough to you know, old enough to have forgotten the imagination of the youth, and think, "Oh, that's ridiculous." But then I got thinking, and I've known about the race for a long time, and I've really wanted to do it. I always thought it was going to be something I'd have to do after I retire. And I said, "Yeah, why not? Let's have a look at this thing." And a retired captain did the race last year, Kevin Greenwood in Ship of Fools.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he is on our proposal. He's our technical advisor. So how we did this, we have a special program called Adventure Training in the military. And it allows any member to put forward an expedition. It can be hiking and camping. It should involve some sort of risk. I think it actually says risk of death.
Exposure to risk. Yeah. Substantial risk or something. It has to be, yeah.
You can't go golfing on a Tuesday kind of thing. Like, no. You actually have to do something that's a little bit more involved.
This meets the criteria of adventure training to a T. So let's do it. And so Max spent a couple months drafting it up, and we were reviewing between Kevin and I. And we had to pitch it to the Admiral, and he said yes, with a few conditions, but I didn't listen to that. It's the yes that
matters. I guess we have to do it now.
Yeah.
So I think it's worth, since, you know, we're not going to have visuals for this, describing the boat, because I think that's pretty original too. I have the unfortunate experience of having about a little over 3 years of documented time on longboats, which are very similar to the boats that you're on. So I think I understand pretty well the pain you are agreeing to undertake. But can you describe a little bit the boat and maybe like what's awesome about it, but also, you know, what's going to be a real challenge about it? And remember, we'll try and do it for like land lovers, right? Yeah. So good luck.
So, The boat is a 27-foot Montague Whaler, and if you look that up online, it's sort of like the classic 1800s or Napoleonic era like ship's boat. If you imagine the Age of Sail and a bunch of guys in a boat pulling on oars, that's basically what it is. For the uninitiated, it's sort of a big long canoe that happens to have a couple of masts sticking up out of it. The masts themselves are only 15 feet tall, and they're tiny little things, and we've got big, huge oars and absolutely zero cover or internal space, which we are working on, where we're trying to build a little bit of shade and a little bit of a hidey hole. But really, it's just a big, open canoe-style vessel with foam blocks up in the nose and all the way back in the transom. So if we do make a mistake and we flip the boat or we flood it full of water, because again, there's no top, we'll still be able to float the boat, figure it out, and get moving again. That's the same reason why it was a rescue boat for the Navy for so many years. You know, out at sea, if somebody went overboard, that'd be the boat that they put in the water, and a bunch of guys rowing would have to go get someone. So it's proven, and it's got the history to it, but it certainly won't be comfortable with it. I think it's going to mostly be fun after the fact if you get my drift.
It's kind of like a whiskey barrel cut in half, top down, and just put in the water.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm reminded of, like, the only other time that people spent a real amount of time on a boat like that was, like, Mutiny on the Bounty, right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
And as I recall, they didn't enjoy that very much.
No, but they did go a heck of a lot further than we're intending to go. So
do that. Yeah. So, you know, it's one of the things you mentioned that I thought was really interesting. And this kind of, I'm bouncing off a little. So I did have a chance to read all of the application that you put through. And one of the things that I noticed a lot, and you mentioned, like, you know, it has little tiny sails, right? It has three little sails, is that not a lot of you were talking about rowing at all or having rowed a lot. And so this is like a compound question. Like, what do you really think you're going to experience on this race? And have you thought much about rowing, or have you, you know, are you just like, we'll figure pain out when pain comes?
Well, there's enough rowing stations for all of us, but we're only going to have four rowing stations because somebody needs to steer. It's got a rudder and a tiller. Plus we want to switch out crew, right? It does not have sliding seats. We would like to put in sliding seats. We have taken it out for a row, and we got her up to what? Three and a half knots.
Was that loaded or unloaded?
Unloaded. Yeah. Not knowing what we're doing. So we got some more practice ahead of us.
The reality is too, that because it's a 1960s Montagu whaler, it points about pretty bad. upwind is 25 degrees off the wind for this boat. And so for the upwind portions, there's going to be a lot of short tacking. We're really hoping for a lot of beam on wind, a lot of reach. and so the expectation is that we're probably going to be rowing quite a bit. And I think all of us have a pretty solid understanding of that. We're hoping to sail. You know, we're putting on big spinnakers, and we're adding a couple of different things to make the boat more sailable, and, you know, so that we can get it moving in as light as wind as possible. But we're probably going to end up rowing more often than not.
We're just mentally preparing for the pain and
the palm.
Yeah. But, you know, the tape, we know the tape's not really going to help that much. It's just suffering.
I mean, the tape is a really good, like, a mental bandage, right? You're like, oh, I'm taping myself, I'll be able to keep going. Yeah, totally. We have this thing called Cornhusker lotion that I guess in Iowa they use for shucking corn. I have no idea, but we always use that on our hands, and it didn't do anything at all except maybe increased our sunburn. But, you know, we felt like we were doing something right. Yeah. So you all have, I mean, because, and not just because of your vocation, the fact that you're in the Navy, but you've participated in a lot of sailing around. Because, well, I should say you all right now are stationed or located in southern Vancouver Island, right? You know, Victoria, Esquimalt, right in there?
Correct.
And you spent a lot of time in the waters, kind of around Vancouver Island, is that?
Yeah, well, four of us have did the Van Aa 360 last year, right. So we've been around the island. I have a long. I'm from the area. I spent a lot of years previous to the Navy. I was a guide, sea kayaking, Central Coast, Northern Vancouver Island. So I know some of the waters.
So, like, a lot of you've seen these waters, you've seen the islands, the beauty of it, the terror of it. The strong currents, the, you know, foul and fair weather. Why are you choosing to package all that up and jam yourselves into an engineless craft and try and go all the way to Ketchikan?
No, why not? This sounds amazing. the dumber it sounds, the more, like, the better the story at the end of the day.
That sounds like a good Max Vandal quote right there. But
I think this is one of those things that if you're the right kind of person for it, you know, you're one of the people who this kind of thing inspires you, you have an opportunity to go and do it, and you don't, you're going to regret that for the rest of your life, right? You know, I don't want to wake up next year wondering what this is like, and I'm okay to pay the price for whatever we're going to run into to have that, you know, and sink or swim. I think we're all kind of dedicated to go and just see and have that experience and get into it.
Yeah.
The other thing too is, like, we, four of us did the Van Isle, but one of the things that we often forget is the original rating for the Van Isle, they actually changed the cutoff for it. So our two boats could participate in the Van Isle because our sailboats are slow. Like, we're not known for being really fast racing sailboats. We have very slow sailboats for a lot of the time. So to have a lot of suck in a situation where, like, this is uncomfortable, that's pretty much the norm for a lot of our sailing.
So this is kind of your comfort zone. This is, like, familiar with this.
Yeah, a perfect example of this is last weekend there was the Paidós Island Classic Yacht Race. It's 70-odd miles. And we went out and we did okay overall with the ratings and the corrections. But for just over the line, we finished 4 minutes before the cutoff for the race end, right? So everybody's wrapping up, they're cleaning up to go home, and we crossed that line because we're still kicking. So.
Oh, yeah, so nothing new. That's perfect. What do y'all, so I imagine the Navy, unless you have some sort of galley duty, you get food cooked for you and served up. What you're on now is a 27-foot boat. You're going to have limited space. Bilge is not very big. A lot of it, you know, fore and aft is watertight compartments, I imagine. What are you doing? What are you doing for food?
Grilled cheese.
Yeah. Are you going to cook aboard or are you going ashore?
Oh, yeah. We're going to cook on board.
You cook aboard?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff
is the cook. He just named himself that.
he has elevated the grilled cheese to new heights of.
There's nothing better than cooking on a boat when you're on your way, as long as it's not super rough.
Yeah.
But be able to sit there and cook a grilled cheese, and you can just try all the different flavors you can possibly think of. Some of them aren't that great, but there are some real winners out there.
It's good that you're eating a lot of cheese because there's no toilet aboard, right? Except the portable MSD. So you're going to want to lock those intestines right up, you know, for a good week and a half or so. So I like the strategy. That's good. That's good. Are you planning on going 24 hours or are you looking for short time?
I think it'll be a little mix of both. I think it'll be weather dependent, current dependent. We're definitely not camping on shore or pulling the boat up on a beach, but we may go to anchor a couple of times here and there. But then, you know, with the daylight and the twilight, you know, this far north this time of year, we'll be able to go throughout the night in watches.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was really excited when I saw that y'all applied for a bunch of different reasons, but one is I always felt that a boat like this is kind of perfect for the race. But it's only really been done once before. I mean, perfect's a strong word for that, maybe. But, you know, it's doable and suitable and fun in its own type 2 kind of way. But did you at all follow, you said you had followed the race for a while. Did you follow Kraken Up in 2016? They may have slipped past you. They were a long dory. So essentially a stretched out dory, 27 feet. They had 8 people, so somewhat similar situation. And I was just curious if they inspired you at all, but I'm guessing not.
Did they complete the race?
Well, if we ended the race in Campbell River, sure, yes. But that brings up another question about completion. Race to Alaska, you know, you said in a lot of ways it's like, it's a culmination of a lot of things. Why not do it, right? This and don't let me put words in your mouth. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what I was getting was that this exists as a challenge that you all can do together that gets your blood boiling in a good way. When you think about the race, you know, one way to define success is to reach Ketchikan. Is that your only way that you're going to define success, or are there other ways?
Reaching Ketchikan is a pretty big, important milestone. I think, you know, given our status as Armed Forces members, I recognize that you don't get a lot of this type of teams entering, and there might be extra attention. And it's not my style to like talk smack about others, you know, before we're newbies. There's lots of people who've done this race many times, right? So, yeah, I'm humbled by everybody who's gone before us, but finishing is definitely an important goal.
Do you have other goals? Maybe, you know, not a success.
Some steak knives.
What was that? What was it?
Some steak knives would be nice.
There was one team I know had a goal. They bought $600 worth of meat and a Stern Pulpit barbecue while they were in Victoria. And their goal was to finish it before they quit. I was like, all right, that's fair. That's good. They happened to make it to Ketchikan, but they weren't really trying that hard. They were more surprised than I was. I'll put it that way. It was good. If you had bands that were going to follow playing songs for you, which are the bands? What are the songs? What's your soundtrack? Do you have a team soundtrack?
What is our soundtrack?
Yeah, well
we have a map.
We'll have to. Yeah. If I could have it my way, I'd probably bring some bagpipes.
Really?
Or a drum.
Who would leave the bagpipes at home?
Max is our musician.
Something. Sea shanties and a fiddle, you know, that kind of thing. Something stirring.
A mix of sea shanties, fiddle, old biking music, and maybe a little bit of Taylor Swift in there.
Yeah.
Put some Leonard Skinner on.
Oh my God, I can't wait to listen to what's drifting across the water like day 12, you know.
Yeah.
Shut that off. I want that. Bagpipes again? What? That'll be perfect. Do you all know sea shanties? Are you going to be singing them?
Oh, yeah.
We'll be learning them. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we got to get in the row. We got to get in sync on the oars. So, song.
So, you, Ellery, you mentioned that there may be more attention, right, on you as a team because of your situation. And I agree. Like, all of the armed forces, all of the Coast Guard, I think joint JRCCs, the rescue command, are going to be, like, tuned into you. Does that make you all nervous?
Not really. I think what I need to mention is that, like, people will think that, like, we're heavily funded and, you know, get anything we can. We're on a pretty tight budget, to be honest. So it's tough both physically for us to do this, but administratively, it's a lot longer process. There's a lot more red tape to make this happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
we're all of us are doing the work. Nobody else is doing the work for us to move this team forward.
Is this for you all a real personal thing, or are there other reasons that you're doing the race? Or is that, you know, like environmental race? Are you raising awareness? Are you trying to get in touch with like your writing, creative writing self? Or
I think it's a little bit personal, but I would also say there might be a visibility of the Canada has a Navy. I don't know about the American Navy right now, but you know, navies around the world are hurting for personnel. We're short people. So there might be an element of like public awareness and recruiting involved. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I'm ever an uncle or a grandfather, I'll have some really cool stories to tell. So that's motivation for me.
The other thing too, I mean, like, so of course this is Max's idea originally, but the thing that appealed to me so deeply about it when he first brought it up was that like we work at the sail training, like Royal Canadian Navy Sail Training Center. We teach sailing and seamanship to junior officers and to NCMs that come and are joining the Navy. And I think that this is one of those things where we can really prove to ourselves and to everybody else that we have something to talk about, that we have that backing and that background in like pure difficult seamanship. Because at the end of the day, we're the Navy. We're supposed to be the, you know, the purveyors of knowledge of this of the ocean of like, we're supposed, that's supposed to be our bread and butter. And, you know, if we can't do this, then what's going on there? You know, like we should be able to get it.
Yeah, I get that. That totally makes sense. What are you all expecting? Like, you know, what do you think it's going to be like? And what do you think are the real challenges that are going to be for you operating, you know, a 27 foot boat, six of you, four rowing stations, open boat?
Somebody said sunburn.
Yeah.
Blisters.
Being wet all the time.
Mm-hmm. Trying to pass Kelsey Bay in the current.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Having a toilet.
Keeping Jeff fed.
I think one of the ones that I contemplate is when we did the Van Isle, I was on a boat that we had engine problems, and then we had halyard problems, and then we wrapped a prop on a rescue boat all while at the finish line of, in the Kelsey Bay area. And then we had to do an emergency anchorage on Helmkin Island with 25 knots of wind and 5 knots of current. So we have a pretty good appreciation for the conditions that we're going to see.
Yeah.
That was a perfect example of when multiple motors failed us. Different boats. Yeah. In the end, it was not motors that were getting us.
We were to the point where we were at an anchorage, and it was really sketchy anchorage. And I'm sitting there in a wetsuit ready to get into the water to stern tie us somewhere to shore because we were very close to a rock. Like, it was not a good situation, but we prevailed from that.
Yeah, I think you all are very well prepared. You definitely know what's out there, you know, along this route, for sure. Is there anything you want to say? I mean, is there anything we haven't talked about?
Well, I think, like, just to hark back to one of your earlier questions, I think that I'd probably speak for everybody in that, like, there is something, like, it is an opportunity for me as a human to challenge myself, to learn something about myself. Like, you know, these are kind of maybe cliches about why people do things, races or, you know, adventures like this. But I'm just like super excited to do it. And I think that being part of the Royal Canadian Navy team, it's an opportunity for us to kind of build community with the other like-minded people who, you know, get into these kinds of races and build connections between the sailing community of Race to Alaska. Like, one theme I've heard in these podcasts is the community around Race to Alaska. And it just seems like a fantastic group of people. And I think we're all excited to get in there and meet people and learn some things and represent the Navy doing that and hopefully build bridges that way.
Yeah. Well said. I mean, it's true. The race builds an ever-growing kind of pretty amazing family of people. I would say probably the best thing about the race is that the challenge of it comes second to the people that can become lifelong friends or mentors or just a really good crowd to be part of which you are now, which is really great. All right, y'all. Fantastic. If not before, we'll see you at the start line. And thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, Jesse, I got a question for you. Does that make you a little nostalgic for the old Outward Bound days when you and I may have been running around in longboats adventuring through all the islands?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm definitely feeling nostalgic about that type of sailing, that type of back to the basics navigation. I am not super nostalgic about sleeping every night for months on top of a set of oars, but how's your nostalgia doing?
I love opening my eyes to a sunrise that is from, you know, one side of me to the other side of me, and there's nothing overhead. And that's kind of that magic of waking up in one of those types of boats. I love living really close to the water like that because, you know, there's just not a lot of distance between where you are and the water. And the camaraderie, but I don't need the type of blisters that is going to 100% give those people on their hands. It's going to be brutal.
So your 2026 bid is not going to be looking like victory or death then?
I'm going to go with a no on that one. Absolutely not.
Okay. All right, great.
They're going to have a hell of an experience. It'll be amazing.
Well, hey, let's talk to yet another team who is going to be putting some big blisters on, and that is Team Hard on Port.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was reading about these two. They're engineers, right? Like rocket ship engineers.
Yeah, they work for Blue Origin.
That's crazy. What, and so what are they doing for race prep?
Oh, well, you know, let's let them tell us.
All right, fair enough.
So you're both together in one space. Where are you?
We're at my house.
In
Kent, sorry. Yeah.
Kent, okay.
Which is adjacent to the shop with the boat, which is why we're here.
Got it. Because it's, for listeners, it's a Sunday morning, and I'm sure that I am wrecking the training plan for the day by scheduling a podcast.
Yeah.
Yep. So we better get through this quick. So I was just reviewing all the stuff I know about both of you, which is limited. Like, I think people out there in the world should know, when we accept you into the race, what we really are looking for is like whether you got the chops to do it, but we don't actually get to know too much about you. So I have to like look between the lines here. Both of you work at Blue Origin helping get people into outer space.
So far, we're only getting people into suborbital space, but we will be getting people into actual outer space.
Sorry, there's a line, isn't there, where it's outer space?
I mean, it's you know, the difference between suborbital and orbital, right? So it's like you go up above the Kármán line, which is technically the limit of space, but then you just come right back down. That's suborbital. Okay. And then if you get fast enough to stay in space for a day or a week or, you know, however long you want, then yeah, that's orbital. So.
But Jeff is wanting you to go there, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're building a giant rocket in Florida that will go to moon and everywhere.
Okay, Race to Alaska World. We're about to get the inside scoop. Classified information from Jeff Bezos. Go.
We don't get to hang out with Jeff that much these days.
So you are, Michael, you are the electrical engineer. Yes. And Connie, you are a systems engineer. Sorry, I'm going to talk about space for just a minute, but I find it fascinating. And then we will talk about how that applies. So what does a systems engineer do on rockets?
Technically, I also work with electronics and avionics. I'm a responsible engineer. I shepherd boxes and designs from paper to onto the rocket.
Oh, that's pretty neat. Electrical engineer seems like it explains itself a little better, but maybe you have a little more nuance you could give us.
Most of what I do at Blue is launch support systems. So it's all the things on the ground that, you know, let the rocket fly. So communications and networks and cameras and, all that sort of thing.
So then what does it feel like? I mean, you got like, you're doing a test fire or something. I know you've got a new rocket staged right now, I think, because I just went to the website and this is how I prepare for interviews. So right now you got a rocket up there. And so if you're working on that part of it, is most of your stress like right when you like hold the Bic lighter to the bottom of the rocket and everything's supposed to go? Is that most of the stress for you in that moment?
I mean, most of the stress is like the few days before that. I mean, especially with like all the ground stuff, yeah. Like, you know, my stuff is, you know, it's not, none of it's like super hard, but there's a bunch of it and the rocket is hard, right? Like launching a rocket, making everything work, doing all that is really hard. So my rule is it should never, ever, ever be ground stuff that makes us not launch.
Uh-huh.
You know, my stuff in theory should be easier than the rocket stuff. And then, so if we can make all my stuff work all the time, then we can get past the bugs, like the rocket difficulties or the weather is not good. Or so my stress is like, be ready, right? Like we're always ready to launch the rocket. And then if it breaks on the rocket, that's, you know, that's expected. It's a rocket. It's complicated. But the, you know, it's like I build the dock and the dock's just supposed to be there. It's just supposed to work. Like you don't expect to walk out on the dock and have them fall into the water. It's just supposed to be there. And then the sailing or the rowing or the pedaling to Alaska is the hard part, right?
Yeah. So, nice transition. That's where we were about to segue. So you've got your rocket is your CLC Dory. That is Chesapeake Lightcraft Dory. It's in the building next to where you are right now. Are all systems go?
almost there.
Yeah.
We're going to get it in under the line.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So are you approaching, so you started building this, what was it, October?
It's been about a year and a half, so yeah.
Okay, so a couple Octobers ago, you started building it. Mm-hmm. As rocket engineers, have you got like the same style, like checklists that I imagine in your work life going? There's like a mission control and checklists and stuff going?
We have lists.
Yeah, there's definitely lists, things to get checked off and steps to complete before the next steps, right? You can't do this thing until you do this other thing first. You can't put the varnish on here until this, rail is glued on.
And you're going full varnish for Race to Alaska. You're shooting for the moon. I mean, obviously.
Well, the quality of the varnish has changed over time. It's like, instead of like 9 coats, maybe it will only be a couple coats and the amount of sanding has decreased. So,
I think in your application, you mentioned something about Lillian. You know Lillian of Race to Alaska fame and ridiculousness. I don't know if you've ever seen her boat up close, but I believe she varnished it once upon a time once.
Yeah.
And did nothing since. So, you could follow in those footsteps.
Right. We did see Lillian's boat in Port Townsend last year.
We did.
We got there on 7048.
Right.
Chatted with Lillian, chatted with Damien, chatted with the other crazy rowing people. So
yeah, we're getting some good batches of rowers the last couple of years. 2 years ago we had Let's Row Maybe and Don't Tell Mom, mm-hmm. kind of doing a similar thing to what you're doing. Yeah. So let's talk rowing.
Okay.
Tell me, how long have you each been rowing?
Let me think about this. I have been rowing relatively seriously for 15 years. I started Renton Rowing, which is down by the Boeing plant on the south end of Lake Washington. I had rowed forever ago before that. And then I showed up at Renton Rowing one day, dressed in jeans and normal clothes. And they're like, hey, get in this boat, come row with us. and I did. And then I never stopped, and then got a lot into the Sound Rowers events. Mm-hmm. If you know them, but they do open water rowing all up and down the Sound. So when I got to 7048, it felt like I've rowed almost all of those places, and it's just, like a Sound Rowers race times 6. So how hard could it be?
Yeah. How about you, Connie?
I started rowing about 5 or so years ago. I used to be a runner. I messed up a foot, and rowing is not impact. So I can obsess about that and do it repetitively every day now. So
got it. Yeah.
About 5 years.
All right. So about 5 years. And you've both done 7048. You've both attempted it multiple times. You've both completed it at least once. In the, we're about a month out from the races, and you've both gone through the process of preparing for 7048 before. And Michael, you went through the process of preparing for Washington 360 the year that happened the first time. How does preparing for Race to Alaska feel compared to preparing for 7048?
Busier. For 7048 and WA360, there was already a boat. And so it was more about the training. Mm-hmm. And this time we wish there was more about the training, but it's a lot more about building and finishing the boat. Sort of our experience on 7048 is you can kind of make your choice, right? You can pick like the fastest boat possible. Which then is way more affected by conditions. And that was the one year we did not compete. We had an open water double, and that was the ugly year that half the field dropped out, and it was just not enough boat for the conditions. So, we chose not to have to be rescued.
Appreciated.
My first year when I did it solo, I took a fairly beastly rowboat that I knew I could row through anything with. And it was true. It worked great, but I wasn't as fast as maybe I could have been. So at this point we chose a boat. Well, we created a boat that we know can take it. We know can do it, but we have to, now finish all those details before we can actually row it to Alaska. Mm-hmm. How does it feel? Yeah, it feels rushed trying to get the boat done. I think based on pictures of Damien's boat before he did last year, it probably feels the same as he did. Uh-huh. Like, finish this darn boat.
Yeah.
I believe Damien was finishing his boat in Victoria.
Yeah, we're hoping to beat that. Yeah. And we met Damien, and he is such a cool, chill guy. But
oh, he's, I remember he hit the dock. He finished last year, hit the dock. And I think later that afternoon, he told me, like, I kind of feel like going back and continuing. Damien, what are you doing, man? You think you might get into that same space? Just you just want to do a Moitessier and continue on?
That's the hope, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, we're, you know, we booked a ferry. We're like, what if we get there early? It's like, I don't know, we could go row and see stuff. So.
Yeah, yeah, there's endless amounts of things to explore up there. Have you spent time up in that area?
I mean, when I worked offshore, we did some work in Alaska. So I've been, you know, in and out a little bit. I'm trying to remember. I've been to Ketchikan on the ferry, but not really.
Sure.
Spend time there. I've been on survey boats, you know, further up Alaska, Anchorage and the Chumigan Islands and Kodiak and all around that area.
Yeah. So I'm sure you're, in addition to preparing the boat and all those logistics, I'm sure you got your nose in nautical charts and you're thinking about the route and all of your choices and places you could hit the shore. There's all the usual things that if I ask, oh, what are you looking forward to seeing? It'd be bears and whales and trees, eagles and the Aurora Borealis and all those things. But in your study of the race course, has anything popped up for you that you said, man, that is going to be awesome to see?
I always thought the Granville Channel and those things could be pretty cool.
Yeah.
But then I read about the other racers in there and they sound like, when you're trying to row through them, potentially less cool. So nice scenery while you're struggling against the current, I think is what that means.
Well, that's half the time, right?
Yeah.
You also get to be with the current in there occasionally from what I hear how tides work.
The proper planning maybe help that.
So I really appreciate it in your application. Your vessel's name is Mrs. Chippy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give the listeners 3 seconds to make the like three mental leaps that it's going to take to know why you called it Mrs. Chippy. I don't think anyone's going to get there unless they have a copy of Endurance sitting on their knee at this point. Tell us why you called the boat Mrs. Chippy.
Yeah, naming is always hard, but the brief version is Mrs. Chippy is a 24-foot originally open boat. The James Caird, which is one of the most famous small boats and completed one of the most famous small boat journeys ever, you know, under command of Ernest Shackleton and some of his crew, was a similar sized boat, similar. It was modified to make it more expedition worthy, but we figured you can't name a boat the James Caird because that's just, you know, I don't know.
I mean, you could, it'd be kind of, I'd think it was funny.
Yeah, you know, I think that would maybe be, I don't know, it might annoy Neptune or something and get you in trouble. But so we wanted to sort of an homage to the James Caird, but not name it the James Caird. And so the carpenter on the Shackleton expedition was a guy called Chippy McNish. And he had a cat on board that the crew just named Mrs. Chippy because, you know, sailors. So yeah, we decided to name our boat Mrs. Chippy after the cat, after Chippy McNish, after the Shackleton expedition. Like you said, many leaps to get there, but it's kind of cool.
I love that. I hope you paint a cat on your boat. I would say this is a good time to encourage all Race to Alaska fans as we are getting closer and closer to the race start. Now is a great time to pick up your old battered copy of Alfred Lansing's book, Endurance. It is an incredible book, and you can get very excited about people doing crazy and wild things and succeeding. And then you can read that recent news article where they actually recently just found the Endurance, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
So actually, Michael, you've been down there.
Yeah. I spent a summer season at the South Pole, working for the polarized coring office at the time they called it Amanda, which was the Antarctic Muon and Neutrino Detector Array. It's a big, big physics science project down there. So I was not one of the physicists, but I was one of the crews out in the ice, drilling holes in the water with hot water and so that they could mount photomultiplier tubes. And it was pretty amazing.
Wow. The Polar Ice Coring Office. That is a great name of an office. So, I mean, you got South Pole. You're both I mean, I can't, like, you're bringing a lot of brains. You're bringing a lot more brains than we who make the race happen bring to it, actually. So with all of your expertise and things, are you doing anything wild and crazy to your boat that we should know about? Or that maybe it's a secret, but you can leak it here.
I mean, I didn't think so, other than it being, excuse me, completely custom from the hull up.
Yeah.
That's no small feat.
Yeah. And, you know, we kept looking for an expedition double and nobody really builds one that quite did what we wanted. So yeah,
we looked at this Atlo, but it was not the right fit for what we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, one thing we decided, maybe this is not a big brain thing, but an experience thing. You know, 2 years ago, we did sort of our Lillian expedition where we just rode around a lot up to about Seymour Narrows and around the islands. And we did that in two singles. And we decided that we hated the camping thing, you know, where you get to a beach and it's low tide. So there's 400 yards of mud and you have to drag all your stuff and you have to drag your boat and you have to camp. And then you have to either wake up at 3 a.m. to catch the tide before it goes out, or you have to do that reverse schlep in the morning. And so we're like, we want to be able to sleep on our boat. And so that was a big, you know, design parameter. Mm-hmm. And we see that Damien actually did that last year. And it seems like it saved him a lot of time and effort. So, so it's not crazy, but it's, we're hoping that'll, you know, save us some hours of carrying and dragging that we can instead invest in rowing.
Sure. Sure. I think maybe a lot of folks who have never traveled in that way, they might not understand the planning, the thinking, the logistics, and the outfitting of the boat that's required to travel in that way. I mean, you're going to have, I imagine, like sleeping boards or some solution to that. Often people will have sleep on oars or, you know, rigging up some kind of a shelter. That is a consideration every time that you need to bed down for the night if the weather dictates. Also, there's a lot of stretches in there where, you know, you've got a rock face and then you've got 200 feet deep. So you're either tying to some little bonsai shrub sticking out of a rock, or you've got to keep going until you find a proper anchorage. It's a lot to do, and it is a way different way of racing to Alaska than sailing. Now, both of you, you also have sailing in your backgrounds. Is that right?
Yeah, we both have sailed.
Does that appeal to you at all, doing it that way?
No.
I mean, yeah.
I love that answer. No way.
Not a happy sailor.
No, I don't.
And then once you get to the point where you're rowing, people are like, well, why don't you just bring a sail? It's like, well, then we wouldn't be rowing, right? It's sort of like at a certain point when it's not a sailboat anymore, it's like, we're just going to optimize it as a rowboat and we're going to row it and rowers. So that's what we do.
I really appreciate that. That's something that is great that comes out of Race to Alaska is clarity of purpose. You have an intention, you're setting boundaries behind it, and that is what you're going to go do. Yeah. So what are you hoping to get out of it?
I don't know. I am looking forward to getting away. It sounds relaxing in many ways for me. compared to some of the normal everyday work and life, very relaxing to row and eat and check the weather and row and sleep and just simpler.
Yeah. Like the engineering jobs involve a lot of multitasking, a lot of things all at the same time that never stop. And, you know, we're hoping that Race to Alaska will be similar to our last trip, where it's basically row, eat, sleep. And it's a hard, but it's hard. Simplified existence when you're doing that. You can only bring so much stuff in the boat and all that stuff, then all that other stuff just doesn't matter anymore. So, it's a little bit of a minimal existence in a good way.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Sometimes kind of hard to come back from something like that. So I wish you luck on the back end already. Connie, Michael, Team Hard on Port, thanks for chatting with me on this Sunday morning. I won't take any more of your time because you've got work to do.
Yes, we do. Great chatting with you, Jesse.
All right, we'll see you in just a couple weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, bye.
All right, bye.
All right, a CLC dory with two kick-ass rowers. That's amazing. It's awesome.
I know, right? I absolutely love when racers take this experience like full on cradle to grave, a pile of wood, they turn it into their own boat, and they take it to Alaska. And I also love that this year we've got a pretty sweet crowd of human powered folks in the running for the Oracle Blister Prize.
Yeah, totally, 100%. Agree. I think there's so many good stories in the Race to Alaska, all these kind of subplots. You know, first place is a big story, but the human powered element, the people who are really living on that race course for a long time, becomes that incredible story of itself. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be fun seeing who takes the Oracle Blister Prize.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to it. And Daniel, thanks for helping me take the time to tell these stories. And we'll catch up next time.
Yeah, absolutely, Jesse. Thanks a lot, man. It's been good catching up.
Race to Alaska is a project of the Northwest Maritime Center in Port Townsend, Washington. To learn about our other projects or how you can support them, please visit us online at nwmaritime.org.